Hello, and welcome to the Comics Ate My Brain Weekly Roundup Podcast. I'm Tom Bondurin. I'm a writer for Robot 6 at comicbookresources.com. Before that, I wrote for Blog at Newsarama, and before that, I was a writer for The Great Curve. And before that, on July 14th, 2004, I started this here comics blog, Comics Ate My Brain. To celebrate, I've decided to branch out into podcasting, so without further ado, let's get right to it, shall we? It's a big week this week, July 8th, 2009. The comics I'll be covering include Wednesday Comics number 1, The Unwritten number 3, House of Mystery number 15, Superman World of New Krypton number 5, Green Lantern number 43, Green Arrow Black Canary number 22, Booster Gold number 22, Batman number 688, and The Warlord number 4. So, here we go. First up is The Warlord number 4, written by Mike Grell, penciled by Joe Prado and Chad Harden, inked by Walden Wong, Wayne Foscher, and Dan Green. This is an issue which ties together the venerable Warlord character, character which I think dates back to 1974 or so. Travis Morgan, the Warlord, who's an Air Force pilot who gets trapped in this fantasy land and becomes sort of a barbarian with a gun, basically. And it's an issue where kind of the cover tells you a lot about what you need to know about the book. Morgan is fighting sort of a half cross between a minotaur and a dinosaur with a sword and his Air Force revolver strapped to his hip, or his Air Force pistol at any rate strapped to his hip. It's an enjoyable issue. Essentially, it reveals what happened to the group of new characters who were introduced in issue number 1. And one of them, well, a couple of them, have become sort of the evil rulers of a section of Skartaris, which is fantasy realm in which the series takes place. Since these characters are sort of the new readers' stand-in characters, it's nice to see them incorporated into the existing Warlord storyline. I'm not particularly familiar with the ins and outs of Warlord continuity, so I appreciate that. And this has been a pretty easy series to follow. I mean, there's, at the risk of giving it a backhanded compliment, it's not particularly sophisticated, at least not to the uninitiated. Essentially, it is a series where an Air Force pilot can find himself fighting a half minotaur, half dinosaur, sort of just out of the blue. And it's a fun series. The art in this issue is handled by two different pencilers, but they have similar styles. Chad Harden and his inkers are a little less, their lines are a little thicker than Joe Prado and his inkers. But, I mean, everybody, you know, it's pretty consistent from first to last page. They're, you know, acceptable storytellers. And like I say, it's easy to follow who everyone is, what they're doing, who they're fighting, that kind of thing. So I'm enjoying Warlord. It's not the most intellectually challenging book I've read, but it gets the job done. Next, we have Booster Gold number 22 by Dan Juergens and Norm Rapmond. Written and penciled by Juergens, inked by Rapmond. It has a second feature, Blue Beetle, which we'll get to in a moment. The lead story in Booster Gold 22 finds Booster traveling back in time to the events of New Teen Titans number 2, which came out in the latter half of 1980. In that issue, the New Teen Titans fought a villain called the Ravager, and at one point in the battle, one of the Titans makes the Ravager think that he has actually killed all of the Teen Titans. That allows a sort of loophole in Booster Gold's time travel rules, whereby the future can be changed. So there is a real danger that Robin and the rest of the Titans can be killed and the future can be altered, and that's what Booster is there to prevent. Now this issue, kind of like the Warlord, I'm happy to say I don't think you have to know a whole lot about New Teen Titans number 2 in order to appreciate what happens in this issue. I mean, personally speaking, I am someone who bought New Teen Titans number 20 or New Teen Titans number 2 when it came out, read it over and over again, you know, the right at the start of one of the seminal runs in DC superhero comics. So, you know, it's old familiar ground for me, but I give Juergens a lot of credit for sort of weaving Booster's tale in and out of it pretty seamlessly. So the issue ends on a cliffhanger, and I'm looking forward to the resolution of it next issue. The co-feature, Blue Beetle, is written by Matthew Sturgis, penciled by Mike Norton, and inked by Norm Rapmund, and it is the second part of a storyline in which the Blue Beetle, Jaime Reyes, fights sort of second generation, actually literally second generation, giant robots. He fought the sort of vacuum tube version of this giant killer robot last issue. Now these co-features are pretty short, 8 to 10 pages, but I've been impressed. I was impressed last issue and impressed this issue with the amount of story that Sturgis and Norton are able to pack into those pages. They are very efficient in that respect. And in addition to all the fighting and zapping and flying around, we also get some nice insight into Jaime's supporting cast, bringing those of us who did not read the Blue Beetle series when it was a monthly comic up to speed on who everybody is and why we should care about them. And it's a pretty fun feature. It actually makes me want to go back and pick up the Blue Beetle trade paperbacks, which for various reasons I haven't had an opportunity to do. But rest assured, this is reawakened my interest in those. So Booster Gold number 22, pretty good issue from first page to last. Mike Norton pencils all of Green Arrow and Black Canary number 22, which was written entirely by Andrew Kreisberg. And because it too has a co-feature, the two stories have different inkers. The lead story features Black Canary and is inked by Joe Rubinstein, and the co-feature features Green Arrow and is inked by Bill Sienkiewicz. And this issue I had a problem with because neither story ends on the sort of note that it builds to. The lead story includes an extended flashback to Black Canary's childhood when she discovers that she has this sonic cry superpower, something which her mother, the original Black Canary, did not have. You know, it's a bit about, you know, kind of the X-Men sort of, oh, I'm a freak, what am I going to do, you know, with these superpowers kind of thing. And a little bit of mother-daughter interaction in that regard. The flashback ties into the lead story because Black Canary finds out that she has inadvertently given this supervillain of the lead story his motivation. Her powers crippled him, or destroyed his livelihood, I should say. And so at the end of the story, she's still sort of, even though it ends on sort of an ironic note with the flashback from Wildcat, another of her mom's Justice Society teammates, telling, you know, giving her a little bit of caution about her powers, she's still sort of charging out at the reader like, you know, she's still ready for action. What's more, the Green Arrow second feature ends with Black Canary sort of suggesting to Ollie, Green Arrow, her husband, that maybe he should give up being Green Arrow because of his hesitancy to stop sort of deranged, fatally attracted supervillain stalker who's been after Green Arrow from, well, that's getting to be a convoluted, isn't it? And the second feature Green Arrow and Cupid, who's his stalker, come across an incident of domestic violence. The guy has stabbed his girlfriend. Excuse me, the guy stabbed his wife. And Green Arrow just sort of hangs back and lets Cupid work out her frustrations on the husband. The police arrive and actually taser Cupid before she can do any real damage to the husband. But Black Canary finds out about this and says, well, you know, you could have stopped him and you didn't, and maybe it's time you take a step back. And, you know, taken together, I can kind of see how those, you know, obviously describing it now, it's easy to see how those two stories will fit together. But at the same time, the last image we had of Black Canary in the feature story, in the lead story, was her sort of, well, yeah, I did this, but I don't care. And maybe that's a failing of Norton and Rubenstein, because, you know, they give us this image of sort of a determined Black Canary charging out at the reader. But all in all, the endings of both stories just sort of seem to come out of the blue for me, and this is going to be a series that I'll have to reevaluate whether I'm going to keep continuing to get it, because it hadn't done a whole lot for me since Judd Winnick stopped writing it. Speaking of Judd Winnick and his not writing things anymore, he does write Batman number 688, which is penciled by Mark Bagley and inked by Rob Hunter. But this week brought the news that they would only be on the book for 4 issues before Tony Daniel comes aboard to write and pencil it for at least 6 issues. And this was not welcome news to me, because I was not particularly impressed with Tony Daniel's work on Battle for the Cal. I thought it was rather disjointed. I thought his characterizations were off. And, you know, not particularly a fan after that, which is really a shame, because Batman number 68 is a really fine example of what I thought Winnick could bring to the book, which is the sort of day-to-day soap opera aspects of a Batman title that fans like me, let's be honest, look for. Especially when you have a circumstance like the present one, where Dick Grayson is the new Batman. He's trying to figure out how he's going to be Batman while honoring the memory of Bruce Wayne. He's training Robin in this issue. He has a couple of logistical conversations with Alfred about, you know, how big to make the eye holes in his mask, what he's going to do about the Batman cape, which is the size of a theater curtain practically. Things like that, you know, sort of the inside baseball aspects of being Batman, which, you know, are appealing, let's face it. Plus the fact that there are look to be some subplots that Winnick is setting up with familiar supporting characters like Commissioner Gordon, as well as rogues like the Penguin and Two-Face. You know, Dick also trains Damian, Bruce's illegitimate son, who's the new Robin in this issue. And it's a nice compliment to Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely's work on Batman and Robin, where they get to do the more high concept, less day-to-day sort of Batman adventures. Winnick seems perfectly comfortable with the other side of that, and, you know, writes a pretty good issue with those sorts of concerns in mind. And Bagley, too, I think, if anything, reading a year's worth of Bagley on Trinity, you know, the man can tell a story. He can lay out a page. He, you know, never really loses sight of what you're supposed to be looking at. He's a fine storyteller, and I was really looking forward to him being on the book. I'm still looking forward to him being on Justice League, but we'll get to that when that actually happens. At any rate, I would say enjoy Winnick and Bagley on Batman while you can, and I'm hoping to be proved wrong by my earlier assessment of Tony Daniel, because if he's anything on the Batman title like he was on Battle for the Cowl, it's going to be a long 6 months. Next up is actually another book that Judd Winnick used to write way, way back, is Green Lantern. I just mentioned that as a transition. It has no other probative value. Anyhow, Green Lantern number 43, the early September 2009 issue, which means that we'll get another issue of GL in a couple of weeks. It was written by Jeff Johns, penciled by Doug Monkey, and inked by Christian Alamy, and it is one creepy issue because it deals with the villain of Blackest Night, or one of the many villains, I'm sure, that will show up in Blackest Night, the Black Hand. Now, Black Hand was a Silver Age Green Lantern supervillain whose claim to fame, as I remember it, was that he spoke almost entirely in cliches, or he had a fondness for cliches. I think he showed up a couple of times in the 60s. He showed up one time in the Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams run in the early 70s. But, you know, didn't leave a real impression at any particular time until Johns decided to bring him in basically a cameo in Green Lantern Rebirth. I think the Spectre, back when Hal Jordan was controlling the Spectre, visited unto him a little bit of God's wrath in Green Lantern Rebirth, and since then he's sort of been lurking in the shadows, waiting, I'm sure, for Blackest Night to start. So, pretty long prologue to the prologue issue there. This issue essentially reminded me of the spotlights on the Rogues Gallery that Jeff Johns did when he was writing Flash. He'd drop in these little one-issue explorations of villains like Heatwave and Captain Cold and Mirror Master. And so this issue, like those, focuses exclusively on Black Hand. There's not a whole lot of Green Lantern in it. But that's okay, because it's a fine origin for Black Hand. Essentially, he has this sort of macabre childhood, I guess, or childhood preoccupied with macabre as a result of growing up in a family of undertakers. He's around death all the time. When he becomes a supervillain, he makes his costume out of a body bag, which I thought was a nice touch. He finds this, I'm going to call it a cosmic control rod, but that's just because I've been reading a lot of, it's a cosmic divining rod, excuse me. I was calling it a cosmic control rod because I'd been reading a Annihilus issues of Fantastic Four. And it absorbs, I'm reading directly from the book, it is a device that demonic alien, Archilo, I think, Atrocitus, built to absorb power, including light, from Green Lantern rings. And so Black Hand, when he's a teenager, comes across this cosmic divining rod, holds onto it for a while, uses it to become a supervillain, and then many, many years later, in this issue, Black Hand finally goes off the deep end, murders his entire family, and in a full-page panel, blows a hole in the side of his head with the cosmic divining rod. And I know there are going to be a lot of people out there who say, well, this is just Jeff Johns reverting to his history of grisly dismemberments as demonstrated in various titles of the mid-2000s. But, you know, I'm willing to give Johns a pass on this because he has gotten away from that in the past few years. He has sort of acquired a better reputation. He never really had a bad reputation as a writer, at least not in the mainstream comics audience. But I think his reputation has been burnished over the past few years, especially with his work on Green Lantern and the Superman titles. And in part, I think it's because he's de-emphasized all the blood and gore, and he's sort of gotten back to solid, fundamentally good storytelling. So he's due for something grisly to happen, and if it's going to be, you know, even if it is one close-up page of the side of Black Hand's head splattering all over the wallpaper, then, you know, vaya con Dios, I suppose. And plus, you know, Monkey and Alamy really draw the heck out of this issue. This is a nicely rendered issue, which is, I don't know, they really make Black Hand look in and out of costume. He just looks cadaverous. His eyes are practically floating behind his mask. He has sort of this wide-eyed look of a combination of innocence and fear and just shock. They're a great looking art team, and I'm glad they're going to be on the book for a while. They're also a nice complement stylistically to Patrick Gleason, who pencils Green Lantern Corps. Anyway, it sets up Black Hand's mission within the Blackest Night crossover, and it's a good wrap-up of what Johns has been doing with Black Hand sort of in the margins of the Green Lantern book. And, you know, good issue overall. Next week, Blackest Night starts in earnest, and I'm sure I'll have more to say about that then. Next is Superman World of New Krypton number 5, written by James Robinson and Greg Rucka, and drawn by Pete Woods. This is another fine-looking issue from the pencil and pen of Pete Woods. It's a good issue overall. I have really enjoyed the World of New Krypton series because it's a different kind of Superman story, which doesn't rely on him losing control over any of his powers. He doesn't have to go nuts. He's not trapped under a red sun or kryptonite chains or anything like that. He gets to be Superman, but it's his environment, this new Kryptonian planet, which is, you know, on the other side of the sun from the Earth, that's given him all these problems, because he's been accepted into the military of that planet under the command of General Zod. This issue features his trial at the hands of Zod for disobeying one of Zod's orders. And the central thread running through it is his ethics, Superman's ethics, as we all know, taught him by his foster parents, the Kents. And that's a great foundation for a Superman. It looks great under Pete Woods, and it draws a lot, as you would expect, from the judicial trappings of the first couple of Superman movies, with the rings that encircle the prisoners, the giant floating heads that, you know, pronounce guilty, guilty. You know, they don't quite do that in this issue, but you get the idea. And the fact that Superman is given an opportunity to escape by the bad guys who are setting him up for even worse things, and he doesn't take it because he believes in the rule of law. So it's a fine issue. As I say, I've really enjoyed this miniseries, and not much more about that one. House of Mystery number 15, written by Matthew Sturgis, penciled by Luca Rossi, and inked by Jose Marzan Jr. and Stefano Landini. House of Mystery 15 is essentially a mythology issue. It's an issue that I liked, but I'm conflicted about why I liked it. House of Mystery generally has not been a series that I have really warmed to, except for the art of Luca Rossi, which I think is really nicely quirky and suits the series very well. I think we're supposed to, as readers of House of Mystery, become invested in these characters. And I really haven't done that. And the revelation at the end of this issue deals with the nature of the House of Mystery, the house itself in which all of these characters are trapped. And it essentially relates the history of this house to previous House of Mystery series that was published by DC for such a long time, and a staple of comics like Sandman. So, you know, I don't know whether I like this issue because it reminds me of the old DC and Sandman stuff, or whether I liked it because, you know, I've reached some sort of critical mass with these characters. Either way, I liked it. I liked the embedded story, which was drawn by David Hahn. It's a goofy little what if we throw in everything in the kitchen sink plus ninja monkeys movie pitch. And I may have to, as with Green Arrow and Black Canary, I may have to revisit House of Mystery to see, you know, just exactly where my affection for it lies and if I wouldn't be better off getting the trade paperbacks. Up next, our penultimate comic for the week is The Unwritten, which was written by Mike Carey and Peter Gross. It is the sort of horror homage issue. It involves a group of horror writers and producers of various, representing various subgenres. They're all stuck out at the house which inspired Mary Shelley to write Frankenstein. And I think we all know when you stick a group of people with disparate interests out in the middle of nowhere at an old creepy mansion, nothing good can come of it, and indeed little does. And that issue would be fine. I mean, that storyline would be fine of itself. But it's folded into the larger narrative about Tommy Taylor, who is, you'll remember, is kind of the adult version of Harry Potter, looking for, or trying to find out what's going to go wrong next with his life, basically, since his father, who is the sort of J.K. Rowling figure, since his father disappeared, and Tommy's life was turned upside down by the revelation that he may actually be the wizard that his father wrote about. So I really like The Unwritten. I liked it from the first issue. And this issue, even though it does deal in sort of hoary horror cliches, it manipulates them quite well. It incorporates them into, like I say, the larger Tommy narrative, and it's a fine series that's off to a really good start. Speaking of off to a really good start, our last issue for the week is Wednesday Comics number 1. And really, if we weren't almost out of time, I would just go through each of these features and say, this is gorgeous, this is beautiful, this is stunning. You know, I can't say enough good things about this issue. I will say that the Teen Titans feature was probably the least successful. I think the composition and the coloring are sort of at odds with each other. But it's still ambitious. Each one of these features is ambitious in its own way. And DC, I've been looking forward to this series for a long time, and I'm glad to see that DC is sticking with it. I hope that it's a success for them, and looking forward to the next 11 issues. And with that, we'll bring this inaugural podcast to a close. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.